I don't know how many times someone has come up to me and said, "Hey, let's dance." I hate dancing.
Greetings, Earthlings. You are listening to the Radio Bowie and MoMA special.
It's a god-awful small affair for the girl with a mouse in her hair. And her mommy is yelling no, 'cause her daddy has told her off. And her friends are nowhere to be seen. Now she walks in a dream, oh yeah, to a seat with a very clear view. Now she's on to the silver screen, and the film is a sounding ball, 'cause she's rolled in 10 times on ball. It's the life on Mars. Oh yeah, I believe there's life on Mars. Thank you.
Don't be a rebel. Listen to Radio with Gareth Jones.
There's a star. Greetings, pop pickers, and welcome along to Radio Radio, an occasional series of podcasts presented by me, Gareth Jones, from Bristol in the UK. Now, it's an occasional series of podcasts. The last one of these I did was at Christmas for my annual Christmas special, but then usually after that, I don't do anything for like 6 or 7 months. I'm a bit of a slacker. But this time I thought, no, Gareth, get off your arse, because David Bowie's died. Yes, everyone else, the TV, the radio, the press, all the media, have swamped you with David Bowie tributes, so I thought it was about time I had a go. And this is no ordinary tribute. I'm not going to be playing you wall-to-wall David Bowie records, I'm going to be playing you wall-to-wall David Bowie cover versions. And first up we had, all the way from Timperley, the fantastic Mr. Frank Sidebottom, actually, played by the late great Chris Seavey, who, like David Bowie, also died, kind of in secrecy, of cancer. He died tragically at the age of 54, he told close friends and family, but nobody really knew until he died what he died of, much like Bowie. And from his sci-fi EP from back in 1986, that was his version of Life on Mars, oh blimey. And then from Colorado, we had the eccentric outsider synth and psychedelic pop singer, the Space Lady. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with the Space Lady, probably not, but she's getting on a bit. She's not passed away, thankfully, she is still with us, but she's a lady of a certain age who wears a silver plastic helmet with wings and a flashing light, and she perches at her cheap keyboard performing cover versions of classic rock songs. You really should check her out. If you go on YouTube and just type The Space Lady, you'll see what she's all about. I saw The Space Lady last year, actually. She played a gig in Bristol, and for the first few minutes you're going, God, this is bloody awful. But then suddenly you're totally mesmerised. So The Space Lady, check her out. And that's just two examples of the bizarre, unusual Bowie cover versions we've got coming up for you on this podcast. I'll also be chatting to the eccentric singer-songwriter Mummus. I actually recorded an interview with him last year, before David Bowie died, and we talked about David Bowie. Though we make no reference to David Bowie dying, obviously, because, well, the interview was recorded before he passed away. But I just thought, I've had this interview in the can, sitting on the shelf, waiting to be used. What better time is there than now, after, tragically, David Bowie has passed away? So I'll be chatting to Mummus about the triple album he released last year, which contained one disc of Bowie covers. So the Mummus interview coming up a little bit later, but back to the cover versions now, and I think this is a great Bowie cover. You'll probably think it's incredibly cheesy. Well, it is incredibly cheesy, but it's still great. From the middle of the 90s, this was a synth duo called the Moog Cookbook. The Moog Cookbook consisted of musicians Brian Kahu, a keyboardist, and Roger Joseph Manning Jr., who was in the early 90s band Jellyfish, if you may recall them. They had like two albums and disappeared, but I thought they were great at the time. After Jellyfish, he formed the Moog Cookbook for a couple of albums, and then he went on to be a keyboardist for Beck and for Morrissey. So he's had quite a good career, really, considering what you're about to hear. The Moog Cookbook released a couple of albums of cover versions. They first released an album of contemporary songs from the 90s, covering Smells Like Teen Spirit, Black Hole Sun, that kind of thing. And then they released an album of classic 70s rock songs. They did Sweet Home Alabama, Hotel California, and this version you're about to hear, the Moog Cookbook covering Ziggy Stardust. Thank you. The Mood Cookbook there, covering Bowie's Ziggy Stardust. Well, is it the Mood Cookbook? Because for many years I thought the word Moog was pronounced Moog. But as it turns out, the inventor of the Moog was a man called Robert Moog. And there's a bit of a debate, really, on whether you pronounce it as Moog or Moog. Let's hear from the man himself. Robert Moog, Robert Moog. How do you pronounce Moog or Moog?
Well, there are three ways of pronouncing M-O-O-G. It's originally a Dutch name. This goes back, you know, 1,000 years or so. And in Holland, you would pronounce it Moch. Now, that's a little bit too much to expect people to do here. In Germany, it's a fairly common name, and there it's pronounced Moog. In Great Britain, English-speaking countries, people see the double O and they say Moog. Now, I just happen to like the sound of Moog better than Moog. Part of my family pronounces it one way, and part pronounces it the other way. So my wife at the time and I, back when we were first married, decided to go for the Moog pronunciation.
Ah, well, I'm glad he's cleared that up. Now I can sleep at night. So it is Bob Moog, not Moog, and the Moog Cookbook. You're listening to Radio Radio. I'm Gareth Jones. It's a David Bowie special. Yeah, okay, I can't do a Bowie impression. Well, it wasn't just David Bowie who passed away in January. A whole slew of people were dropping like flies. In fact, just before January, on the 28th of December, we lost Lemmy from Motorhead, aged 70. Also in January, we lost Natalie Cole, daughter of Nat King Cole, aged 65. We lost Glenn Frey from the Eagles, who co-wrote Hotel California, of course. He also performed The Heat Is On from Beverly Hills Cop. He died at the age of 67. Jimmy Bain. Now, I had to... look up Jimmy Bain. I wasn't quite sure what he did. But it turns out he was a former bass player for Rainbow. Now, I don't mean Zippy, George and Bungle. I'm talking about Rainbow the rock band, who gave us Since You've Been Gone. He was gone at the age of 68. Also, we lost Paul Cantor, guitarist of Jefferson Airplane, aged 74. And most recently, we lost Colin Vercombe from the band Black, at just the age of 53, due to a car accident. But don't get too upset about Colin dying, because there's no need to laugh or cry, because he had a wonderful, wonderful life. But it's Bowie we're here to talk about, and of course Bowie died at the age of 69, just 2 days after his 69th birthday, from cancer, which was a shock to us all. And then 4 days later, the actor Alan Rickman also died at the age of 69, also from cancer. Really, that's quite an incredible coincidence. Quite a sad coincidence, but incredible nonetheless. And it kind of got me thinking, like two major artists, both dying at the age of 69, both dying of cancer. Maybe they're part of a new club. You obviously know the 27 Club. Jim Morrison, Kurt Cobain, Amy Winehouse, Brian Jones from the Rolling Stones. They all died at the age of 27. So could we now be looking at a new celebrity death club? The 69 Club. Actually, thinking about it, the 69 Club could have all sorts of connotations. So please, celebrities, do not die at the age of 69. Please at least live till 70 or die at 68. Thanks very much. Back to the Bowie covers now, and this is a corking version of Suffragette City.
Thank you.
Ha! That's an absolutely corking version there of Suffragette City by a band I know absolutely nothing about called Golden Delicious. I know it's an apple, but beyond that, I know nothing. Can't find anything about them online. Maybe it was anything recorded, who knows. But that was taken from an album released in the mid-90s called Crash Course for the Ravers, a tribute album to David Bowie. Other artists on there included The Magnetic Fields, Mercury Rev, Quasi, however it's pronounced, and a load of other bands I've never heard of, including Golden Delicious. But that was a corking version there of Suffragette City. You're listening to Radio Radio. My name's Gareth Jones. It's the David Bowie and Mummers special, and it's Mummers that we'll be dealing with next on the programme. Mummers is a highly prolific artist, and The Guardian, no less, have described him as the David Bowie of the art pop underground. So there you go. In March last year, he released a triple album. Yes, he did a Prince. One album of new material and two discs of cover versions, including a disc of Bowie cover versions. So we'll be talking about that in a couple of moments. I must stress, this interview was recorded last year, and it was obviously before David Bowie died, so we make no reference to David Bowie's death in the interview. But Mummers doesn't stop there. He is the most prolific artist around. Not content with releasing a triple album in March last year, he then released another album in December. December just gone. So from his current album, I thought we'd get away from the Bowie tracks just for a moment and hear an original song by Mummers. So from his most recent album, Glyptotech, this is The Manticore. And we'll be speaking to Mummers straight after this.
Speak up my prick. Let us speak up my big dad dick. His plucky fight against arithmetic. My advancing age has set the stage. My dick is dead. My big dick is dead. Like a great beached whale, he lies upon the shore of my beach-like bed. I can even hear him snore. What does he dream of all the cunts he's seen? With his single eye, his beady eye, I will bury him deep in a hole of human flesh, in the cunt of a cheap, grudgingly willing wench. That's the only place he's gonna rest in peace, for the sake of me and humanity. My big dead dick was dragging down this world, he's making me sick, polluting every girl, spreading his wild oats where there should have been corn. He'd be better off dead, or maybe making porn. Let us speak no more of that atrocious bore, that egomaniac, that manticore which devours a man, leaving not even a bone or belonging behind. Nor did he leave mine.
Delighted to speak to Mummers, aka Nick Curry. Obviously, there have been plenty of artists over the years who've gone under different names, but usually people who've got bad names. So Harry Webb is a terrible name, so Cliff Richard was obviously much better. But I thought Nick Curry was a perfectly adequate performance name. So had you always decided from the outset to perform under a pseudonym?
Well, I had a band, like everybody does when they start out, called The Happy Family, which wasn't a particularly great name at the time because it was the early 80s, and Blancmange had an album called Happy Families, which was bad timing the same year. I never liked my own name, Nick Curry. I don't know, maybe I've got sort of family issues to work through there or something, but I mean, it sounds like, in Japanese, Niku Kari means meat curry. curried meat, so it sounds a bit silly in Japanese as well. I don't know, something appealed to me about Momus. I like fables and fairy tales and things, and Momus is a character in Aesop's fables. He pops up in various strange contexts, like in Kafka's The Castle. He's a minor bureaucrat. He's always a minor something or other, which seems to have been my fate as well.
Of course, I only discovered this recently on Wikipedia, that you are the cousin of Justin Curry from Delamitri.
He's the major Curry, yes.
Although obviously from the same family, but poles apart musically.
Yeah, I mean, he's my dad's brother's son. So my dad's brother actually is an orchestral, a choral conductor, or has been. He's retired now. But that's where the music talent in the family is, if any side. But, you know, I'm probably more literary because I went to university and did literature. And Justin just went straight into a music career and did very well and signed to A&M and Chrysalis and people like that. So he's got a house now. I rent and he owns. That's the major difference between the Curries.
And yet you're very prolific, whereas Delamitri, nothing ever happens. Nothing happens at all. I had to get that in there.
So. You did. You levered it. Yeah, levered it in.
But you are, I'm losing count now. Is it 29 albums?
I think it's about 30, actually, yeah.
You and The Fall are probably the most, in the UK, yeah. Probably the most prolific artist.
It's funny, I've just written a novel about Marquis Smith.
Oh, really?
In which Marquis Smith becomes the figurehead for a weird new religion, a very intolerant and misanthropic religion, which aims to take over the world. But being prolific, I guess it's just a desire not to be bored, you know, just to work because you either have a Protestant work ethic, which may well apply to Marquis Smith and to me, that we are Calvinists in our approach to staying active, but also it could just be that you're easily bored. I mean, I divide my life up into 3-month slots, you know, I'm in Japan for 3 months and then I come back here for a month and do concerts and things. In Japan, I'm either making a record or writing a book. So those 3-month slots, you know, I've got to fill, because otherwise I'll get up to no good.
With all the labels you've been with through the years, through L4AD Creation, did any of them kind of go, whoa, slow down? Because it's kind of like an album a year, really.
No, actually, it was pretty good. For instance, Creation had to put a certain number of records through Pinnacle every year, and they just wanted the turnover. They had these very difficult thrawn artists like My Bloody Valentine, who would spend a lot of money and a lot of time in studios making the perfect masterwork. I'm totally the opposite. I just sort of throw whatever material I'm coming up with out as quick as possible, shoddily recorded sometimes, or... And I don't really care. I just want there to be a certain throughput. I don't know. Almost hackwork approach. I quite like things being half-formed and half-finished, not too polished. Maybe the opposite of Delamitri again in that sense. God, I'm going to sound obsessed with Delamitri. You shouldn't have raised Delamitri.
I do apologize.
No, we're on good terms and everything. No, we like each other.
But this year you've released a triple album. I mean, talk about prolific.
Well, it's just because I did a cabaret last year, two cabarets at Café Otto in London, covering Bowie and Devoto songs, Howard Devoto from Magazine and the Buzzcocks. So I just had all this material recorded anyway, and I just thought I'd put it all out with my own new album. So first triple album I've done, though, yeah. From Potsdamer Platz, you never knew that I could do that. Just walking the dead. Sitting in the jungle, Nürnbergerstrasse, a man lost in time, near Cardiff, just walking the dead. People cross
Peppers and Brew. Fingers are crossed, just in case. Just won't keep the dead.
Now, your current album, Triple Album, includes an album of David Bowie covers.
Yeah. Why did that come about? No, I've just been a lifelong David Bowie fan. I mean, he set the template for this kind of quick change multimedia artist that I wanted to be, I suppose. You know, very physical and very glamorous and sexy and all the rest of it. So I just kind of felt it was payback time. And then the day he released this single, Where Are We Now, I made an instant cover version of it, which to my enormous surprise was then featured on his own website. So he'd obviously heard it. But it's just my way to try and work out where this influence had come from and also how the hell he sang things like Sweet Thing. You know, how you go all those octaves very, very low to very, very high in such a short space, and how you orchestrate and arrange that. It was really fascinating to get inside the arrangements of those songs, which I'd heard and knew backwards, but hadn't ever tried to sing.
I think it would only be fair to choose a track by Bowie, if that's okay with you.
Oh, wow. Maybe After All from the Man Who Sold the World album. I really like that. And I was, you know, 11 or something when that came out, so get them when they're young.
Please trip them gently, they don't like to fall.
Oh, by jingo.
There's no room for anger, we're all very small.
Oh, by jingo.
We're painting our faces and dressing in thoughts from the skies, from paradise. But they think that we're holding a secretive ball. Won't someone invite them? They're just taller children. That's all. After all, man is an obstacle, sad as the clown. Some people are marching together, and some on their own, quite alone. Others are running, the smaller ones crawl, But some sit in silence, they're just older children. That's all. I'm sorry I called, but the thought just occurred, we're nobody's children. Ooh.
It's interesting because in this current climate, a lot of people now are absorbing music through, say, Spotify, making playlists, and people are talking about the idea of the album as an art form dying because people are just picking tracks.
Yeah.
I mean, you're very forward-thinking and into technology, so I would have thought in one way you would embrace Spotify, and yet in another way you would still want to make an album.
Yeah, that's a difficult question. In a way, it's a habit pattern now for me just to turn albums out because I'm of the generation that thought albums were kind of important and, you know, came of age in the 70s and all the rest of it. But I'm fine with people picking and choosing as well. I've got enough material out there that people can make their own Spotify playlists and make pretty long ones. So, yeah, it's fine. And it's also fine to mix and match and everything. I don't know. I mean, Lou Reed used to say that you know, a CD, especially when CDs came out, you could make a 60-minute album, which would be almost like a novel or an opera or something. I'm not really precious about that. I think for me, the important thing is that you want to know. It's like being attracted to someone sexually. You want to know what's going on in their mind. You want to sort of step into that world that is their world that they've created and that is their personality, their smell almost. If you become fascinated by a creator in that same way as a lover, that could happen from just one song or it could happen from 30 albums, you know. As long as it's available, I think that's the main thing. It used to be really hard to get your work across to people, and now with the internet, it's so easy. I don't really care about Spotify not paying very much money, blah, blah, blah. Who cares, really? We all make enough money in the developed world to eat and to live, and, you know, most of us. You can cobble a living together from various activities. I do journalism and writing and stuff as well. Yeah, it's fine, as long as it's out there and people can find it.
You can make your definitive Moments playlist as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you haven't put out, like, the ultimate best of yet.
No, I'm not really into box sets and things. I think there is a re-release program. An American label is trying to re-release my early albums, and good luck to them.
Also, a current thing, which, because record labels are less likely to sign artists now as much as they were in the 90s, whatever, a lot of bands are doing it for themselves. The Kickstarter site, for example, it's almost like accepted now by artists to do it. It's not frowned upon. Amanda Palmer, who covered one of your songs, and she was very famous for doing it. But you were, in many ways, pioneering, because years before Kickstarter, it was to pay off, we won't have to go into all the legal details, but it was to obviously pay off for a legal matter. Mm. You funded, it wasn't so much funding the album, it was paying legal fees, but you funded it through your website. But that was back in like 97 or something?
99, actually. Yeah, I let people have a song portrait made, because I'd run up legal bills and I had to pay them off. And then I said, for $1,000, I'll write a song portrait of you. And... which you can alter, and you know, if you don't like it, and that sold really amazingly well. It sold out 30 songs within 2 or 3 weeks or something. Actually, there was a guy, Yancy Strickler, is the guy who set up Kickstarter, and he was frequenting a bulletin board that I was on just around that time. So he may have got the idea partly through that. I mean, my idea at the time was patronage pop. That there are different financing models that have applied in the art world and in the publishing world. For instance, in the 18th century, they had a thing called subscription publishing, where if you were a poet, you could go to usually aristocrats and people around town and ask each of them to subscribe, put their names down and subscribe a bit of money, and then you'd produce a volume. Or the king would be your patron or something, and you'd have to write a fulsome preface to your poem about how great the king was. But, you know, there are lots of different models. Or you could make CDs much more expensive, make it 5,000. I think the KLF were the first to do that in the 80s. They had one copy of 1987, What the F is Going On, their sampledelic kind of album, which they sold for £5,000. You know, the art world has been fairly inventive in its pricing structure. You don't need to just always have this one item which you sell for one fixed price, a mass market price. If you sell fewer copies especially, you have to investigate these slightly more canny ways to make money from them. I mean, now people have 360 degree deals where they're marketing t-shirts and all the rest of it, as well as live concerts and the records are all part of a management package. It's kind of necessary now because the records themselves don't make so much. It used to be that concerts were adverts for records, and now it's the other way around, that records are adverts for concerts. So here I am, earning an honest pound, a cubic pound.
a lot of reviews I've read over the years, maybe it's lazy journalism, they instantly compare you to the Pet Shop Boys, which I would imagine is equally flattering and lazy. Where do you feel on that?
Well, I used to, at one point I was aspiring to be the third Pet Shop Boy, you know, around about 1990, and I got Pet Shop Boys fans, because the Pet Shop Boys, of course, are gay and they have straight fans, so all the straight fans would come to me knowing that I was like a heterosexual Pet Shop Boy. That was quite a pleasant time in my life. And I was actually trying through their manager. I think Tom Watkins was going to sign me up, and Spaghetti Records, who signed up, it was a guy called Cicero, who's this Scottish guy who never got anywhere, unfortunately, but was on their label.
I think he had one hit,
that's possible, yeah. I was hoping to be the next Cicero, which would have been a fate worse than ended up having, I suppose. But I wasn't offended at all. No, they're good songwriters. I really like Love is a Bourgeois Concept on their last album. That sounded very like one of my songs. But I don't really know anymore which way around it is. Was I influenced by them? Were they influenced by me? I've met Neil a few times, and I always say, you know, we both sing about loyal retainers in songs. Is that a coincidence? And he's like, oh, it's just smoke and mirrors, you know. It's just, there's nothing in it. Which I'm sure there isn't. Great minds think alike, you know.
You've lived in Scotland, London, America, Japan. Where do you really call home now?
Well, I still feel Scottish, and I feel, Ed Miliband, you idiot, why are you ruling out any alliance with the Progressive Scottish National Party, etc., etc.? Well, you know, I feel patriotic fervour when I see Nicola Sturgeon or whatever. Alex Salmond. I actually like those posters where Alex Salmond is enormous and has a tiny Ed Miliband in his top pocket. You know, I think, yeah, that's how it should be. I live in Japan, so I'm sort of electively Japanese in some way, but you can never be Japanese if you're not Japanese. You have to be born with the Japanese blood and culture. There's no way you can sort of go native in Japan, really. Although I do sit on mats, you know, on the ground and eat with chopsticks and everything when I'm there. I like to think I'm a bit of a Ryanair world citizen, you know. We can all be world citizens these days for very little money.
Momus, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Strikes the bell for 5 o'clock. Uncle Arthur closes shop, screws the tops on all the bottles, turns the lights out, locks it up, climbs across his bike and he's away. Cycles past the gasworks, past the river, down the high street, back to mother. It's another empty day. Uncle Arthur writes his mummy. Uncle Arthur still reads comics. Uncle Arthur follows Batman. Round and round the rumours fly, how he ran away from mum on his 32nd birthday, told her that he'd found a chum. Mother cried and raved and yelled and fussed. Arthur left her no illusion, brought the girl round safe, confusion. Sally was the real thing, not just lust. Uncle Arthur vanished quickly. Uncle Arthur and his new bride. Uncle Arthur follows Sally. Round and round goes Arthur's head. Hasn't eaten well for days. Little Sally may be lovely, but cooking leaves her in a maze. Uncle Arthur packed his bags and fled. Back to mother, all's forgiven. Serving in the family shop, he gets his pocket money, he's well fed. Uncle Arthur past the gasworks. Uncle Arthur past the river. Uncle Arthur down the high street. Uncle Arthur follows mother.
Ending the Momus interview there with his version of the 1967 Bowie track, Uncle Arthur, which was recorded and released at the same sort of time as The Laughing Gnome during Bowie's Cockney musical period. And you can hear that track and many others that he's covered by Bowie on the triple CD called Terpsichore. It is on Spotify, or you could shell out and actually buy the physical thing. Terpsichore, his triple album released last year, and Momus also has a new album which has just come out called Glyptotech. So two new releases from Momus to buy, and you can see him live, not tragically in Bristol, where I am, which I did see him live last year, which is where I recorded the interview, but he will be back in the UK. He's performing in London at Café Otto, where he originally did a cabaret show doing Bowie songs. Café Otto in London on Friday the 25th of March. And then he's in Manchester at Gulliver's on Sunday the 27th of March. So Friday the 25th of March, Café Otto, and Sunday the 27th of March at Gulliver's in Manchester. And if you want to find out anything else that he's up to, his website is imommus.com. That's not the word I, that's the letter I. The letter I, mommus, M-O-M-U-S.com. And no doubt he'll be releasing another album before I've even made another podcast. He's that prolific. Well, we've almost reached the end of this Bowie Mommus special, but a couple more cover versions to play. I couldn't resist playing this one. Ye, Rip fans! Roland Ratt released a couple of albums in the 80s. He did a version of Elvis Presley's Love Me Tender, as I recall, but he also did David Bowie's Fame. Now, there's no malice in this. I mean, it's bloody awful. It really is terrible. But the creator of Roland Ratt was a David Bowie fan. Still is a David Bowie fan. So I'm sure it was meant with sincerity. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty bad. So Roland Ratt will be now performing Fame. Yeah. And then, well, a real treat for you. To end the show, I thought, well, I'll wait till we get there and introduce it at the end. But first of all, Rip fans, is Roland Ratt with Fame.
And hard to swallow.
Fame
puts you there where things are all alone.
Fame. Fame.
It's mine, it's mine, it's just a line enough to send a man into crime. Yeah. Get it's no tomorrow.
Fame.
What you need, you have to borrow.
Fame.
Fame. It's not a flame, it's just a game. Enough to send you totally insane.
Oh,
Rallying Rat Superstar. That's Rallying Rat Superstar from his difficult second album, Living Legend, with his version of David Bowie's Fame. Other tracks on that amazing album include Guinea Pig in Love, Hair Loss, Linda the Canteen Girl, and of course, Trousers. Yes, Living Legend, the difficult second album by Rolling Rat Superstar, now available in all bad charity shops as we speak, I'm sure. Well, that wraps up this edition of Radio Radio, the occasional podcast, but on this occasion it was actually pretty quick. I banged one out not long after Christmas. But who knows when the next one will be? It'll be sometime later this year, when somebody else dies, probably. But I'm going to leave you now with, one of my favourite David Bowie covers, with a full-on Yorkshire brass band. This is John Otway. John Otway released a whole album of cover versions, and this is really the pinnacle moment on the disc. This is John Otway with a Yorkshire brass band taking on the might of Space Oddity. So I'll leave you with this. Thanks very much for listening. I hope that if you're a major David Bowie fan, you've not been offended by these cover versions. I'm sure he's looking down now, having a chuckle as we speak. Thanks very much for listening. See you next time. Cheerio.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take protein pills and don't tell them at all. Ground control to Major Tom. Commence the countdown. Engines on. Check ignition and may God's love be with you.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0,
lift off. This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made great. And papers want to know, yes you are. Now it's time to leave capsule. If you dare.
This is Major Tom to ground control. I'm stepping through door. And I'm floating in most peculiar way. And stars look very different today.
Thank you.
original version of Space Oddity, I sang, "Ground control, I miss my mum. Ground control, I miss my mum."